Hello and welcome. This is Alan Side. We are together here, and this is A Path with Heart, a telesummit on nonviolent communication and social change. The reason I created this telesummit is because this is a topic whose time has come. Our planet's life support systems are going through significant stress. At the same time, human society is in an unprecedented time historically. Never before have there been so many humans on the planet at one time. Never before have we humans been so interconnected and starkly aware of our interrelatedness and our interdependence. Never before has the human family experienced such promise, such peril, and such opportunity. Marshall Rosenberg's process, Nonviolent Communication, which was named out of a sense of alignment with Gandhi's movement of truth-telling and compassion, is a world-famous, proven, time-tested methodology for creating exceptional personal and professional relationships, for offering compassionate understanding to others and knowing when and how to ask for it ourselves, for preventing and resolving misunderstandings and conflicts, for speaking our truth in a way that is more likely to lead to harmony than conflict, and for creating mutual understanding without coercion. In this interview series, I'm conversing with NVC trainers and others for whom I have a great deal of respect and whose work I admire. My guest on this call is Peggy Smith. For over 2 years, Peggy has shared NVC with men in a pre-release program. She is a co-founder of the Maine NVC Network, a certified NVC trainer, and editor of the monthly educational NVC newsletter, Phases of the Moon. Peggy loves teaching her intro courses as well as her advanced NVC integration program. She's shared NVC with educators from war-torn regions of the world through Seeds of Peace International Camp, including traveling to Israel and Palestine. She has developed a workshop that combines Buddhist meditation with NVC as a direct expression of the precept of deep listening and right speech. Peggy is the mother and stepmother of 4 adult children and currently is the care provider for her mother with dementia. She loves walking with her dog, playing in water, and organic gardening. Peggy, welcome.
It's really nice to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you, and I'm so glad that you said yes. So, why did you choose the title Only Humans Here?
It's very important to me in my NVC work to remember that no matter what label we put on someone, simple labels like gender labels or age labels, but also label CEO or banker, or criminal, prisoner. All these labels separate myself somewhat from that person. It's one of the things I so enjoy about Marshall's teaching, of really helping me see how any label at all is a way that I distance myself from the other. And when I was first thinking about talking about my work with people who are incarcerated, I thought of the title, No Victims, No Perpetrators. And then I realized I wanted it to be a positive statement as opposed to a negative statement, what people aren't. And so I want us to always remember in our work that in myself and in the other, we're human, universally connected by these innate needs. And I don't need to look at your title, your classification. I can look through that to your humanity.
So what is the Reentry Center, first of all?
This Reentry Center is for men coming out of either county jail or state prison who will be returning to this region. It's a cooperative group of 3 counties here on the coast of Maine, where the sheriff devised this program to help people who are leaving incarceration to have more skills than they went in, the kind of skills that will help them be more successful, at being contributing members of their communities when they return. So there's two, in a sense, two populations, some coming from county, which means they've had sentences of less than a year, and people coming from the prison system where they would have had sentences of longer than a year. The hope is that they will learn skills that will contribute to their well-being, their family's well-being, their community's well-being. And these men receive a number of classes, and one of the classes is 10 weeks of nonviolent communication.
What's the basic structure of the course, either the 10 weeks or for the sessions themselves?
Well, my dream is that the people who participate will leave after 10 weeks understanding, in fact, that they have feelings, because many of them come into class saying that they don't feel anything, and that those feelings are arising from innate, beautiful needs. That's my real agenda, not necessarily that they're fluent in the four-step process. And in a typical session, which is 2 hours, we do a check-in. That way I find out what's alive in each of the people, or at least what they're willing to share about what's alive in them. And frequently, because of living in such close quarters and in a domination structure, like a prison, people come in with certain triggers and sometimes with celebrations. And within a few weeks, it really touches me, the depth of trust that seems to unfold, and people share honestly about what is alive in them. And that's always the juicy part for me, because then I take whatever's really alive in them and make that the focus of our session, with their permission. I always come with a curriculum in mind for the day, but I always hold that very lightly, knowing that I want to go with the energy in the room. So if there's something really alive, that's what we do. And what I mean by that is, if someone shares something that they're willing to work through with the group, whether it's a celebration or a trigger, I help them delineate what's the observation. I write that up on a chalkboard, and then they share their feelings, or sometimes I have the group guess what that one member might be feeling, so that they can see a wide expanse of possibility. And also during that time, I can also model if something shared that's really a judgment thought, like I feel betrayed, we can work it out organically together. What are the more vulnerable needs underneath that word? And then the group guesses what the possible needs are. And then, of course, the person chooses which needs are really up for them. And depending on where we are in our 10-week session, I guide them to some sort of request that they might make.
So
does that help you give a sense of that?
Absolutely. Is it always only men?
Yes. This particular reentry center where I work is for men only. There's another reentry center about an hour's drive from here, which are for women only.
I imagine that some of the men, because of their experience of being behind bars and perhaps other life experiences, that some of them probably come in with a considerable amount of trauma. And I'm wondering if that's been an obstacle or how you work with that.
Well, I would say, of course. It's my belief that almost every human being on the planet is working with some level of trauma. As you said in our introduction, I do believe that the human species is at a point of deciding whether we want to continue or not to exist. And whether we think about that in our conscious mind or not, I believe we're all resonating with that. I think the work that groups like the HeartMath Institute are doing help us see so concretely through science that, in fact, interbeing exists. We truly are influenced by each other, not even by our overt acts and words, but that our hearts are speaking to each other all the time at a vibrational level. So I believe that all humans are in some state of trauma, and most of the men that I work with there have heightened trauma, you might say, by putting a label on it.
Yeah.
That's why many of them, when I first introduce nonviolent communication, and I do it through a model that I learned from Greg Kendrick, who I believe you also interviewed for the Tele Summit.
Yes.
And so I don't know if I didn't actually hear his talk, whether he talked about the four chairs.
No. Go ahead.
Ah, well, so this is, I don't introduce NVC as we often do through the idea and imagery of giraffes and jackals, because it just didn't resonate with me that it would work very well in that setting. So I use Greg's way of talking about four chairs, and I line up in front of the class four chairs. And I do this in all my workshops, whether they're in the prison or in the public workshop. I ask everybody to think of one statement that was ever made to them that they didn't enjoy. And then I ask if there's a volunteer who would share that statement so that I could demonstrate the process. And there's always somebody. And then I get in chair one, the person shares the statement, and I'm that them in this for the exercise. So they become the deliverer of the message, and I'm them. And chair one is what we would call jackal out. It's blaming the other person.
Yeah.
So they say the statement, and then I share what my mind is thinking, not necessarily the words I say. And I use different vocabulary often at the reentry center than I do in public workshops. But we want to speak in ways that our audience will connect to what we're saying.
Yeah.
But I make judgmental statements. And then I move to chair two, and they repeat the statement. And then I say out loud my self-blaming statements. And then I talk about how we're all moving from chair one or chair two, trying to figure out whose fault everything is in our life.
Yeah.
And then this process gives me two other choices. And I literally sit in the third chair, and I self-connect when the statement is said to the feelings and needs that are in me in the moment. And then I get into chair four, and I make an empathetic guess back to the person when they share the statement. And so that's the other piece that I work with in all my workshops, is saying, if nothing else, can you, in any moment of the day, be aware of what chair your mind is sitting in this moment? Not even seeing chair one or chair two as bad, but just what this is where my mind is, because my mind spends a lot of time there. And it's when it's there, but I'm not aware that it's there, that it actually causes a disconnection within myself to how I really want to be in the world. So self-awareness of what chair I'm in is, to me, the beginning of the choices of having a more connecting life. And that's often our first lesson.
Yeah, I can imagine the light bulbs really going off for people, and at the end of 10 weeks, a significant portion of them really experiencing some transformation in terms of their own level of self-connectedness, in terms of choosing how they want to live their life, and really, this opening doorways for different ways of being in the world.
Exactly. Actually, having a choice to be different than they've been patterned to be.
Yes.
And I really I stress with them a lot that this is not their fault. That it's, and also not even, it's not a psychological dysfunction. It's the fruit of living and being raised in a domination culture. So we're all there. And then I want to cycle back to what you were asking about trauma. So it's invariably someone in the first classes, but I don't feel anything. Or they'll make it more general. They'll say, well, what about people who don't feel? And I say, oh, well, those people are laying on the floor. They're what Marshall called nice dead people. They're disconnected from themselves. And there are many of us out there in that state. We may know some of our feelings, but there are other feelings that we stay hidden from within ourselves. The psychologist Raphael Kushner talks about how what feelings and sensations we're afraid to have actually rule us, because we'll do anything to avoid them.
Sure.
And NBC has really given me tools to find out I wasn't even aware of what feelings I was unwilling to have, right? Because I was all those negotiations were done very underground in my mind, so I wasn't aware of them. And it's actually the NBC trainer, Liv Larson, has written a book that, to me, is one of the most transformational books I've ever read, called Anger, Guilt, and Shame, Reclaiming Power and Choice. And it's through her work that I got to see how much I avoided the sensation of shame and how that controlled so much of my world experience. And because that work is really alive for me now, I think it's I understand when someone says, I don't feel. I actually understand that, because I realized that for many, many decades, I didn't experience the feeling of shame. Not that I wasn't having the experience, but I didn't allow myself to be aware of it. And so we work with that. We work with even allowing ourselves to feel what we feel. It's a big part of our work there.
Yeah. Thank you.
In fact, it was a beautiful moment in one class. One of the men was sharing what they had done that got them where they were. And in the middle of his story, he started to cry. And then he leapt up and ran out of the room. About 20 minutes later, he came back and he sat down and he turned to the group and he said, I've never cried in front of other men before. And it was such a freeing moment for him. So, and everybody felt it. So it's one of the reasons why I so enjoy sharing NBC, well, with everybody. But when you're working with incarcerated people, it almost ramps up the intensity of the moments of vulnerability that get shared.
Wow, thank you. Well, and you've done a lot of work in the Middle East and in South Asia, working with educators. I'd love to hear more about the work that you've done in other parts of the world, and what are some of the things that you learned there?
Can I say one more thing about my jail group before I move on?
Absolutely.
Okay. Because I think this is a really important piece for people who've experienced trauma, especially if they perceive themselves as the perpetrators of the trauma. As Dominic Barter says, I mean, I loved how Dominic says he doesn't use the word perpetrator and victim, because everybody thinks they're a victim. And the reality is that at least all of us in the first world are in some level perpetrators of this pain and suffering that's happening on this planet right now. So instead of parsing all that out, I think it's really important for all of us to focus on what Marshall calls giving freely. Most of the people who perceive themselves and who society perceives as perpetrators never get a chance to contemplate or even to be aware that they've done nice things for people. They're constantly being asked to express their shame and their regret. And so in our second class, I ask people, I introduce the four steps of the process by asking people to remember and to write down a time they did something nice for someone. And sometimes it takes me a while to cajole them to finding something, because some of them will say, I've never done anything nice for anyone. And it's such a poignant moment for me that I was an elementary school teacher for 32 years. I knew these people when they were 6 and 7, beautiful, innocent lights, although some of them were already traumatized by that age. Yeah? So it's so important for me that everyone see that they are a gift somewhere inside of themselves, and that these needs that motivate our actions, even our most tragic actions, the needs themselves are beautiful and precious. And to me, that's my favorite class of my 10 classes, because I'll say, well, you know, when you were 4, maybe you picked dandelions for your grandmother. You know, search back. I know you can find something. And they all do. And I end up sometimes hearing the most amazing stories. And I just shake my head thinking, no one would believe that a human being who had done this or that is now sitting incarcerated. It's just amazing to me. One man was sharing how he had moved to another state and had gotten what we might call food stamps.
Mm-hmm.
And then he got a job, so he actually didn't need the food stamps. And so he used the food stamps every week to go to the store and buy barbecue food and go to the place where the homeless people lived and cooked a barbecue for them. And another man was sharing how he went to a very large box store. I don't like to advertise them, so I won't use their name.
Okay.
Right before Christmas, and saw a tree with little papers hanging on them. And he said, well, that looks pathetic. And he went over, and he saw that they had children's names written on the tree. And he says, I took that whole tree home. I said, well, what did you do with it? He says, I went out and I bought a bicycle for every single child whose name was on that tree. And I was floored by that. And I was afraid to ask, well, how did you get the money to do that? But it turned out that his father had died of the lung condition that develops when you're exposed to asbestos.
Yes.
And so he was getting a survivor's benefit check. And he took that check out and bought however many, 20, 30, 40 bicycles, so that children didn't have the same Christmas experience that he had remembered having as a child, when what his parents could afford to buy him was a pair of socks. So I think it's so important for all of us to remember to use our NVC not only on the things that are triggering or upsetting for us, but also on reflecting on the beautiful, loving things we have done and the beautiful and loving things people have done for us.
Yeah, gratitude and appreciation is such an enormous part of nonviolent communication. Often it can get overlooked.
I agree. And I think it's so important to remember, because if we only use NVC for processing the things that are upsetting to us, then our own internal system will start associating NVC with problems. And so if my mind is wanting to think in that way, my internal system is going to start getting into that vigilant, there's a problem. But the reality is, so will everyone else around us. If we only use our NVC consciousness to talk about issues, then everyone else around us will associate NVC with issues. So important to use it for being aware of and expressing our gratitude.
Thank you.
So thank you for letting me cycle back to the jail work, because even though it's highlighted at the jail, it's, I think, important in all of our work to remember to connect to the beauty of what we do as well as the other challenging parts.
Mm-hmm. And any time during our conversation, Peggy, you can come back to that or to anything you want.
Great.
Yeah, and thank you. That was I found that really beautiful. So, but before I ask you about your work in the Middle East and South Asia, I have a different question now that's up for
mm-hmm.
me.
Mm-hmm.
How do you define social change, and how do you see social change happening? How do you see us humans effecting social change?
Mm. Oh, it's such a big question.
Yeah. Well, first defining social change and then defining the process of how you see us making it happen.
Yeah. I think the answer to that question is different for everyone. So the act of social change is to find out what it is in you, what's your passion, and to move in that direction. To be more awake, more alive in our lives, creating the flow. What's your flow? And for some of us, it can be a small, I didn't even like calling it small. For some of us, transforming our own thinking is huge. Our conditioning, our trauma experiences makes even contemplating what chair am I sitting in? A huge act of social change. And then for some of us, being out in the world and speaking to hundreds or thousands of people, that's our flow for social change. So I remember on the trainers list, someone I think from Northern Europe wrote in when we were talking about social change and people saying, you know, social change begins in me, you know, Gandhi's invitation, be the change you want to see in the world. And the comment was, well, that's interesting for people who live in individualistically focused societies and perhaps in more community-oriented societies, social change happens in a more larger group context. I just have a lot of curiosity about it. I don't have an answer,
mm-hmm.
really, I think, is what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
I think for each of us it's important. I think social change is when my neighbor calls me, like my neighbor called me a week and a half ago and left a message that included a threat, for me to take the time to work through my fear reactions and all the other things that came up for me, so that when I engage with my neighbor again, I'm coming from a place where I'm really willing to connect with them, not necessarily just being a fake nice person. To me, that's social change. Another social change effort is to, like in Maine, we create a free educational NVC newsletter that comes out every month. We have over 3 years of archived articles so that people could have a wealth of resources to continue their NVC study either at home or with a local practice group. It's all right there for people to go and find. That's another form of social change. And then going into the jail, of course, I'm hoping helps create a connection for a population that would never come to a public NVC workshop. Likewise, I think the work that some of the trainers are doing that are going into large corporations, helping people receive NVC training in the course of their work, to me that's also amazing forms of social change. So I think we always, as long as we're in our flow, in our passion, and perhaps being willing to explore our edges, or not get too comfortable where we are, knowing that the call is great, the need is great. So when I've chunked out something and I'm starting to feel comfortable with that, do I have enough energy to maintain self-care and then expand my edges into a new area, like you've done by creating this teleconference. And I'd love to hear, if you're willing, how that resonates with you and if something else comes up in you hearing that.
I'm touched by the request. As you were speaking, I found that the image that I was getting is a very organic and fluid, and it reminds me of, say, a natural ecosystem like a forest, where you have all kinds of different niches, and so you might have some woodpeckers that are eating certain things out of some of the trees, but then you have some birds that really hang out up high on the canopy, and you have others that hang out lower in bushes, and there's so many different spaces that are filled. And in social change work, similarly, I think that for those of us who want to create positive change, some people will be drawn to working with people coming out of jails and prisons, and some of us will be drawn to working in early childhood education, and others of us will be driven to work with or feel called to work with people who are writing policy for transportation issues, let's say. So there are all these different niches in which positive change agents or change makers, you know, where we feel drawn to work. And so that's definitely consistent and with how I experience it. And also, I like that you brought it back to our own self-care and our own growth and evolution, because I think that's one of the challenges that people who want to create positive change, sometimes we run into challenges when we think that we don't need to learn and grow anymore. When we think we're done learning and growing and everybody should just see the world our way, I think that becomes a challenge in terms of working collaboratively with others and our own, you know, continuing to expand our own perspective. So I do see that social change does really start in that intrapersonal space, and then every one of our conversations, like when you mentioned, you know, receiving that message from your neighbor, and all the way up to, you know, working with systems and structures and transforming how systems and structures operate, and transforming the culture inside organizations. So, you know, basically, Peggy, it really, what you shared really resonates with me, and the work does need to happen on all levels simultaneously. And so wherever people are drawn to work and whatever they have a lot of energy and joy for, and what's going to be growthful for them is all going to contribute to the bigger picture. I'm curious how that resonates for you.
Yeah. I so enjoyed the natural systems imagery. It really worked for me. Just last night, someone was talking to me about the beetles, that their job is to go up through the ground to the dead bodies of, let's say, rodents, and kind of suck the stuff out of them back into the ground. Those beetles, who we may never even see, are so vital to the success of life, just as much as the beautiful bald eagle that's soaring across the sky. And so I think everyone involved in NBC is a social change agent, as long as they're continuing to use this process of connection and keep it alive in their life. Some of us are seen, some of us aren't seen, but we're still all doing the work. Thank you. I really enjoyed that image. And I was thinking also, as you were talking, and you mentioned, yes, and then there's some people doing the systems change. And I heard this voice in my mind going, oh, I can't even imagine that. I have no, I'm not drawn to that in any way. And then another voice said, oh, not in this moment, but who knows, 6 months from now, maybe this will interest you. So I think that's one of the so surprising things about NVC is that it's taking me, I mean, I turned 60 last summer, and it's taking me in directions I never imagined I would go. So it's such a life-giving process. I'm hoping that's encouraging to somebody who's listening.
Yeah. Well, and a simple example of systems change is that the sheriff that you mentioned creating a program, a pre-reentry program, and having somebody like you teaching a class as part of that, you know, that's an example of something being incorporated at the level of a system, even if it's in the area of three counties in the state of Maine. But, you know, could that happen statewide?
Yeah.
You know, could it happen beyond that and in many other states? And what other kinds of structures or systems could be implemented to make everybody's life more wonderful? So that's an example of what I mean by systems and structures.
Yes, absolutely. And it all, you know, it's like there's, it all has to work together as life itself has to work together.
Yeah.
It is working together.
Yeah.
And I think I have more and more trust that it's happening in so many different surprising ways, most of which I have no idea about. But I trust that it is starting to happen, and teleconferences like this is an example of that to me and really nurtures that need of trust.
Mm-hmm. So are you ready to switch to another track?
Sure.
So you've worked with educators from Egypt, Jordan, Palestine, Israel, Pakistan, Afghanistan, India. You know, what are some meaningful learnings for you from that work?
Mm. Yes, thank you. This is, again, an example of how I'm saying that NVC is taking me in such surprising paths. Here I am living. I'm an old homesteader in the state of Maine. I don't travel too much. As I was telling you, my phone still hangs on the wall and is connected, the speaker part that is connected to the phone by a cord. So while I have an interest in world affairs and have certainly a lot of concern about really traumatic things happening around the world, I didn't see a way to personally become involved other than to perhaps donate some money. And then about a year ago on the NVC trainers list, there was a request. Was there a trainer who was interested in going to work at the Seeds of Peace International Camp, which happens to be here in Maine? And that camp brings together youth from those countries. Last year it was from those countries and included youth from the U.S. as well, to come together and have a summer camp experience that Maine is famous for, as well as having a dedicated time every day to speak with youth from the other side of the conflict that they're in. So that there's a Middle East conflict time and a South Asian conflict time. Then how I became involved is they also run a program for the educators who accompany these youth from their sending countries. They have their own program. And they have 2.5 hours a day dedicated to dialogue. And we, in that group, we're all together. The educators from all of those countries are together in the same room. And over the years, the director of that program tried many different strategies for helping facilitate the dialogue between the educators. And last year, they decided to have a focus of NVC as being the basis of that dialogue. And, it was another one of these NVC life-changing experiences for me. And you asked me what have been some of the deepest learnings for me. And I think what I got from that experience, and then in December I had the good fortune of traveling to the Middle East. I haven't yet been to South Asia, but I went to the Middle East and did three one-day NBC trainings, one for the education ministry in Israel, and two for educators in the West Bank, one in the north of the West Bank and one in the south of the West Bank. And the clearest piece that I have taken away from that is so clearly in myself coming to understand that the opposite of love is not hate, that the opposite of love is fear.
Fear?
Fear.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've heard people say that before, but I think it came into me at a very more in an embodied way. And that opens up my heart to the people who I perceive as being, having so much pain in the world, that I have in a new way, in a new level, embodied understanding the deep fear that is underneath this behavior. Even if that's not their direct experience. Like, they might not say, I'm afraid, that's why I'm doing this.
Right.
But I can see that. And that gives me a way, for me personally, to enter into this connecting relationship with anybody.
Mm.
Well, I'm not sure I can do it with everybody, anybody, but it's I'm in that direction.
Mm-hmm. So the fear itself gives you an entry point into the connection. Is that what you're saying?
Well, the fear opens up my compassion towards people who are doing things that my mind just can't wrap itself around.
Mm.
Like, can't you see that by saying that or doing that, you're causing so much suffering? That's one part of my mind saying that.
Yeah.
And when my mind says that, whether they're, you know, a banker making decisions that I wish they weren't making, that's causing so much pain and suffering in the United States, or somebody who's making a policy about where people should live in the Middle East, all these decisions that part of me just can't even begin to wrap my mind around. Why would somebody do that? When I can connect to the fear that their motivation at some level is their own fear, then my compassionate nature can step forward.
Got it. And that under the fear are universal human needs, which you also share.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that they share. When I'm pissed off at them, then it's hard for me to remember.
Yeah.
Except maybe in my mental mind. My mental mind says, oh, yes, they share the same needs. But but for me to truly open my heart, I need to really embody that, not just think that.
Yeah. Yeah, just reflecting on how much depth Marshall Rosenberg's gift to us really has. So let me ask you something about needs, because one of the things that you know, has come up from time to time in various conversations with trainers is the way that we use the language. And so tell me about your perspective on the languaging around needs are met or needs are unmet. Tell me more about, you know, your perspective on that.
Thank you for asking. I know that this is part of how I apply my own processing of NBC to my teaching. And I found that in my own processing, as I was learning and trying to embody NBC, that I came to experience that if I found myself saying, okay, when this happens, I feel this, because the need of or originally, because my need of, say, trust was not met. I was only partway to the place where my heart was open to the other person. I find that that traditional phrase is often still, for me, when I'm using it, an indication that I'm not fully, I haven't fully composted the situation.
Yeah.
And I'm not in the beauty and the fullness, the wholeness of the needs. I think English is such an interesting language to work with MVC, because I want to be in the wholeness, the W-H-O-L-E, wholeness of the need. Whereas when I say, because my need of, say, trust is not met, I'm in the H-O-L-E, wholeness of it. I think there's something missing. So I found that in my own work that there were two essential things for me to change in the sentence frame. The first was to just lop off was not met. So I want to say, when, you know, such and such happened, I feel such and such because of the need of trust. I'm just going to pick on trust as an example.
Mm-hmm.
That helps. When I can get to that place, then I know I'm moving towards the W-H-O-L-E, wholeness, the beauty of that need of trust. I'm focusing on this beautiful innate need in me that actually no one can damage.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
So, and you don't even say because my need for trust, you just say because of the need for trust.
Yeah, so that's the second part that I found important to change.
Mm.
If I'm talking about my need, one, it's separating me from remembering this is a universal need. The need of, let's say, trust is in me and in you.
Yeah.
And in this person who I think is doing something that's upsetting to me. So if I'm identifying this as my need, you know, whenever I use the word my, there's a little whine to it. The W-H-I-N-E kind of whine.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to just say because of the need. And I think that that really helps, you know, in the situation we find as trainers is that people, I was on a call-in show once, and a live call-in show, and someone called and said, I hate NBC. I'm like, oh, keep breathing. And it turned out that someone in their family had been to an intro workshop and had gotten just a little bit of information and had gone home and said, well, you know, when you do this, it bothers because of my need for, and it becomes that sort of demanding, like, oh, I've just decided, found out I have needs, so let me throw them all around so you have to do something about it. So I think that by helping people go right to the idea that it's the need, not mine or yours, sort of shortens that time when we're throwing NBC around as a way to try to get our way.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a strategy that I think has been useful.
So what other languaging do you use other than met and not met when you're trying to describe that sense or that experience?
I would say nurtured or honored. I'm trying to nurture the need.
Yeah.
I want to understand that that need is already there. The other piece about met that starts getting me a little itchy is our meaning, I think, at least people from North America are very sort of action-oriented and moving ahead constantly oriented. Okay, so the need of trust, I met that. And underneath that is a subtle thought that if I meet that, then that's done. I can put that away and move on to the next thing that needs to be met. Whereas I think of needs as plants, and I want to nurture them. I don't want them to go away. I want them actually to just grow and bloom and be beautiful and part of life. So I'm never trying to meet the need. I'm just trying to nurture the need. So in fact, it gets stronger. And I
Thank
think that's
you.
One of the other reasons why, to me, met and unmet hasn't been as satisfactory as I would enjoy.
Got it. Thank you. Yeah. There's a lot to think about and consider in that. And I've also had some struggles with met and unmet, and even with the word need itself. I know many of us have searched for other words that might convey the meaning of that, but this is what we have right now.
Exactly. I was just saying that to the new group I was working with today at the Reentry Center, because, of course, we always do this, well, what does the word need mean to you, before we even start with NVC's definition. And we always get to some sense of it's a weakness, it's whininess, it's blah, blah, blah. And I say, you know, I acknowledge that the word need has a bad rap, and it's the word we're working with. You know, we sort of move from there. And and yet when we then do the exploration of how to define these essences, and what I usually do now in my groups is to, and this has come to me, and not, I think, directly from the, I don't know who created this activity, but it's come to me through a variety of generations. But I just invite people to imagine themselves as instantly having gotten a PhD both in cultural anthropology and time travel, and that they can visit any human being from the past, present, or future on any part of the planet. And they interview all these people and ask, what's the most important thing for your well-being, for you to thrive as a human being? And what would be the things that everyone would agree on? And it was so touching to me at the Reentry Center today. We ended up with probably a list of 40 or 50 things, all of which would be on an NVC needs list. And then I said, okay, would you raise your hand if you don't have any of these qualities in you, these yearnings, trust, love, companionship, learning and growth? Raise your hand if you don't have all of these. And not anyone raised their hand. They could all see, yes, I want all of those things too. These qualities live in me. And we just happen to call them needs.
Yeah. So Peggy, I'm wondering whether I moved away from your work with educators in the Middle East and South Asia prematurely, and I'm wondering if there's anything more that you want to say about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, just that people are hungry. They're hungry to return to our innate compassionate nature. Given half a chance, I see people so hungry for skills and tools. And the beauty of NVC is that everyone sees it in themselves. And it's been heartened with those educators who came to camp. They're there for 3 weeks. And which is not a tremendous amount of time to transform. I mean, so they had about 2 hours a day and not even for 3 weeks, because we do a lot of other field trips and things like that with folks. So let's say they had, 10 days of actual real working for 2 hours. And to hear how they've gone home and transformed how they do their work with their students in their home countries is just amazing. And one of the things we did was to create some feelings and needs cards in we used just the deck that I usually use, and now I'm creating the cards that are in English and Arabic and Hebrew, and people taking those cards home and using them with their students and showing their students how to find the feelings and needs that are going on for them. It's just really touching, and I guess social change work is just something that my heart enjoys so much. I'm not sure there's more right now that I have to say about it.
Thank you. What do you see as your current learning edge or growing edge?
Well, I think I alluded to it earlier on, which is the work with shame.
Yeah.
And so discovering even within myself the emotions or feelings that I resisted experiencing. Mm-hmm. And I think the trainer, Liv Larson, what she's created for me has been the most powerful NVC learning since I first read Marshall's work.
Tell us the title of Liv's book again.
It's called Anger, Guilt, and Shame, Reclaiming Power and Choice. And right now, Liv self-publishes that.
I wanted our listeners to be able to hear it again.
Mm. And I just wrote a review of that in the March edition of the newsletter. So people might be interested in our newsletter, our meaning the main NVC network.
Yeah.
And they can find the archived, all the archived pieces at mainnvcnetwork.org/newsletter-archives.htm. But if they go to mainnvcnetwork.org and just follow the news page, they'll find the newsletter.
And Maine spelled as in the United States, state of Maine, M-A-I-N-E.
Yes. Thank you.
And actually, Peggy, your information box on the Telesummit website that has your photo, your bio description, we have that link at the bottom of that information box, as well as your personal website, opencommunication.org.
Yes.
So are these the best ways for people to follow up with you if they want to learn more, if they want to be in touch, if they want to maybe invite you to do a class where they are? Is this how people can contact you through those websites?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, perfect. So,
and another piece of my personal learning edge, so that's sort of like my internal learning edge.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed what you said before, that it's so important to keep learning. Keep learning. So I'm actually in May, I'm traveling to Ohio to take a training with some other NVC trainers. I think it's so important to keep learning, hear how other people present material, keeping myself open to new ways of presenting and internalizing is what helps keep me really alive. And I think keep it fresh so that it's interesting for me. So working with this and really learning how to use shame as the door to self-awareness is creating so much expansiveness for me. So that's my personal learning. And then on my professional learning edge is I had decided that I wanted to explore how to bring NVC into the workplace. And so that's sort of my professional edge, is I want to develop more and more skills at bringing NVC into workplace settings. I've worked with a business of 400 employees who do respite care and day programs for adults with developmental disabilities. And many of these people would never have signed up for an NVC workshop, but I saw how transformational it was for them to receive this information at work. And so I want to learn more skills on how to approach businesses, how to connect with them, how to, you know, devise programs that work in that setting. So keeping it new and fresh is, for all of us, I think, really important. And then I think also sustainability. Maine, the state of Maine, has a great interest in local sustainability, in food sources, in other aspects of building community. But yet, I think a pioneer process through all of this is the sustainability of human relationships. So I can create a cooperative farm, but if I don't know how to get along with the other people on the farm, how long will it stay together? And so helping to connect with those social change movements that are about sustainability and creating sustainable communication. And so I offer a course through the University of Maine for credit called Sustainable Communication, in which we learn and explore nonviolent communication.
Love that.
Mm-hmm.
I love that.
Yeah. So social change movements are often, of course, filled with angry people. Their motivation has been, they've been motivated by their fear and anger about what's happening on the planet. And that's important. And within that, how do we continue to build our compassion while we're saying no to destruction? One of my personal teachers, the Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh, his first book, the first book of his that I read, which is called Pieces Every Step, talked about when he first came to the United States in the late 60s and experienced a peace march, which he said was so filled with angry people that he saw how important what he was wanting to say was towards the peace movement. And I think what we're trying to do in our NBC work is so important to the sustainability movement. We come to sustainability through our pain, and we want to build new structures, not just stop the destruction. And Joanna Macy talks a lot about that in her work of Active Hope, her book Active Hope, and her whole movement of the Great Turning. We're in the Great Turning as a species. Yes, we need to stop as much destruction as possible and at the same time build these new ways of being with each other. And that's the gift that nonviolent communication holds, in my opinion. I was thinking I was just preaching there. Is that okay?
Well, I was experiencing myself as inspired and uplifted.
Great.
Yeah. Well, and because sustainability is such a huge passion of mine and was before I even learned about nonviolent communication, and it's what clicked for me about NBC.
Mm-hmm.
That intrigued me enough to continue to pursue NBC more deeply. So yeah, you and I are definitely on the same page there.
And in the work that I've done with some local Occupy groups and also cooperatives that end up splintering because people aren't getting along with each other. They've even come together with the same intention. But of course, we're coming together from our conditioned minds. And so NVC is such a powerful way to help us connect to that innate human nature of compassion. And isn't it so wonderful that neuroscience is helping us see this truly is a part of our innate human nature? So as Marshall says, we're just unlearning what we've been acculturated to believe. And I think it's a very important gift that we have to offer the cooperative, sustainable, whatever you want to call, movement.
So Peggy.
Yes.
Speaking of conditioned minds, tell us a little bit about your work with Buddhism, Buddhist meditation, and NVC.
It's hard for me to see where one is and where the edges are, the boundaries between the two, because to me they totally inter are. Mindfulness meditation gave me a way to really see my mind and gave me a lot of experience of what it means to be present. And for me, in NVC, we call presence empathy. We have a different term, but it's the same thing for me. To me, empathy is the ability to be present in this moment with either parts of myself or with another being who's with me. And it's the skills that I've developed through my meditation practice that has led to my ability to be present. And at the same time, the whole invitation through Buddhism, the term that's often used is right speech. In the Thich Nhat Hanh community, we call it mindful speech. I've always aspired to that, but how do I do it? I want to have deep listening and mindful speech, but my conditioned mind didn't quite know how to get there. So the first strategy I developed was just to stop talking, which is useful, can be useful, but NVC gave me specific ways of taking the conditioned mind that's conditioned from chair one and chair two. Whose fault is it? To a whole other way of thinking. It's like brought that whole aspect of right speech to life. And that's the name of the retreat that I teach, Bringing Mindful Speech to Life. I think NVC is the key that helped unlock that door for me. And I think as in any spiritual community, it's important to make it alive in our day and age. And how do I actualize the great teachers? I mean, the Buddha was one of many, many great teachers that have walked this planet who've said the same thing. Slightly different versions, perhaps, different words, but all pointing to the same direction. What is the core? Love and compassion. How do I bring that to a meaningful way of life? And to me, NVC is just such a very concrete way to do it. And that brought a story to mind. I hope you don't mind one more story.
No.
Last summer when I was at Seeds of Peace, one of the activities that happened was that through art, we explored the different national narratives. And they got put on the same piece of cloth right next to each other. Now, these are the national narratives of countries who have been at war with each other, where you look across the room and see people who have created, in your mind, create a lot of suffering for people who look like you, or talk like you. So this was very triggering for people to hear each other's national narratives. And then we used NVC in a fishbowl situation to help people express what pain came up for them in hearing each other's national narrative. And we were having people guess the needs of the person who was expressing their pain. And at one moment, one of the educators, who happened to be from Jordan, sort of looked up and started to giggle and said, well, I was going to guess the need of love, but of course it's the need of love. I mean, it's always the need of love, so why would we even guess the need of love? Because it's a given. It's always love. And that just is such a beautiful memory for me, and it's a bell of mindfulness for me, that every, at the core of all humans, is this beautiful need of love that we're all searching for, skillfully or unskillfully. It's so much what we're searching for all the time that, like the air that we're walking through, we don't see it. I'm not sure how I got started on that story. I'm sorry, Ellen, but it's one of the most meaningful stories that came out of my experience last summer at Seeds of Peace.
Yeah.
Can we remember that we're all searching for love?
Yeah. Well, I have what I think is one final question, and although there may be more that emerge between now and you know, your the end of your response, but if you're open to switching tracks again, unless there's more you want to say about anything else we've talked about so far.
No, I'm good.
So let's say that a young person hears this. They go to your website. They find you. They find a way to contact you. By young person, I mean 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. Anyway, somebody really, you know, freshly out of school or soon to be out of school. They're enthusiastic about contributing meaningfully to creating a better world. And they say, Peggy, I would like your guidance or your advice. What's the number one piece of advice you can give me? What would you say to them?
Such a deep and tender question, Alan, that I'm really just wanting to sit with it for a moment.
Mm.
I think I would ask them, when do they feel most alive, most happy in their own skin? And I think the conversation would move from there. I think
you would engage in a dialogue and allow things to emerge rather than just give them some advice or suggestions.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I like that. Is there anything
a part
else?
Of me would say, what advice could I give? I want to be present with who's ever asking the question, because I believe their own wisdom is the best advice. But helping us and having people hear us so that we can hear our own inner wisdom, if I can offer that gift to anybody, then that would be a great gift.
Yeah, so you would engage with them in a way that would facilitate a process of them looking more deeply in themselves, connecting with their own inner wisdom, and then moving from there.
Yes.
Beautiful. Thank you. So Peggy, as we wrap up the call and the interview, are there any parting thoughts or any closing thoughts that you would like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I was just sharing today with my group at the Reentry Center. I said, you know, all my life I've heard older people say, life is so short. But I never really understood it. And now that I can round up to 100 with my age, I go, oh, wow, this happens so quickly. Even though sometimes in our life it seems so long. So I think, what do I want to say is, like, the greatest gift is to know that, to be open to the surprise of the next moment. And that's the gift that NVC has really helped me do more and more, to be surprised and open to the next moment of this precious gift that we call life.
Well, Peggy, thank you so much for joining me on this call and for joining us in the Telesummit. And again, for anyone who would like to follow up with Peggy, you can find the links to her website and also to the newsletter archive that she mentioned at the bottom of her information box on the Telesummit website. Thank you so much, Peggy.
Thank you so much, Alan. I've really enjoyed it.
Me too.